Welcome to Close Up Radio, where our hosts, Doug Llewellyn and Jim Masters, bring you the amazing stories of people who answered the call to unlock their potential and taken control of their own success with authenticity, creativity, persistence, and resilience. Close Up Radio special guests share their knowledge and wisdom so you, the listener, can live the most empowered life possible. Close Up Radio. And now, here's today's host, Doug Llewellyn.
Well, thank you so much. Hi, everybody. I am Doug Llewellyn. It's nice to have you with us today. You know, we talk to people who do all kinds of things in their lives. And many are absolutely they're all very fascinating, indeed, to say the least. We're going to talk to a writer today. And I love to talk to writers. And I love to learn what made them realize they wanted to write. A lot of them, you know, a lot of people that we talk to, we don't talk to that many, but, you know, some write various kinds of books, some write biographies. It's just that at some point in their life, they decide they want to sit down and write. Our guest today is Tom Glenn. He has an amazing story, and he's done many, many things. But as he puts it, he was born to write. It was his inner calling and his mission. He is a Vietnam vet who has had multiple careers, including intelligence operative. He's a musician, a linguist in seven different languages. Think about that, seven different languages, a cryptologist, and a caregiver for the dying, and he's a leadership coach. Educated, highly educated, a BA in music, a master's in government, and a doctorate in public administration. And he's a sought-after public speaker. He's the author of a series of novels, and we'll tell you about those novels and the books as we go along. But he's the one who points out he was born to write. It was his inner calling and his mission. So 30 years ago, he retired from the government to write full-time, and the books and the stories he writes are ones he was born to tell. So we're gonna go through Tom's story. It's quite amazing. He had a rough upbringing as the child of an alcoholic mother and a father who was in prison. And he points out to escape his troubling home life, he got a job as a paper boy, a delivery boy, a drugstore clerk, a restaurant bus boy, and eventually a waiter. He worked his way through college and spent his graduation day in the hospital suffering from exhaustion. And early in his life, he learned the value of work and the need for self-reliance, a quality that served him well during his years in combat in Vietnam. Anyway, well, let's talk about that. Rather than me tell Tom's story, we're going to bring Tom on and let him tell his story and find out a little bit about what brought him to this field of writing. He's headquartered in Columbia, Maryland. It's between Washington and Baltimore, a lovely area of the U.S. Tom, welcome. Nice to have you with us today. How are you?
Oh, thank you very much. I'm doing fine, and I'm very pleased to be here.
Listen, it's a treat to be able to talk to someone like you. I know that you said you were born to write, but you had to have certain experiences in life before you could really actually sit down and start to write, because you had to live so many stories and experiences to know what you wanted to write. At least I think that's probably correct. Talk to me a little bit about your decision to become a writer. I gave you a little bit of your background, and we'll get into that. But at what point did you decide to say, look, I think I can write. I'm going to leave the government, leave my job, and sit down and write. How did that come about, and at what point? Talk about it.
What happened was that because of my time in combat, I suffer from post-traumatic stress injury with all of the symptoms of that, the irrational rages, the panic attacks, the flashbacks, all of it. And because I had top secret code word clearances working for the government during all kinds of classified stuff I can't talk about, I couldn't go for therapy. So this was something I had to take on for myself. I discovered early on that what I had to do was to bring those unbearable memories into my conscious mind, face them head on, learn to live with them without going into panic every time they came across my mind. So I did that. I practiced it, and I found out that the best way for me to get those memories focused in my rational mind was to write them down. So I started writing all the unspeakable, terrible things that had happened to me while I was in combat. things I can't really talk about. Watching men right beside me being killed in ways that were so ghastly that I still can't talk about it. So I did. I started writing. That ended up being books, particularly Laughter of the Enemies, which is the story set during the fall of Saigon, because I lived through that, escaped under fire after it at the very end. Long story about that that we can get into later if you want. But
sure.
That's how all the writing started. And once I did that, I went on and wrote other books. Most of it came from
your experience?
My need to face my past, my memories. And once I got started on writing, I was able to keep going. So does that answer your question?
It does. I mean, you've led me there. Let me just ask you something. You talked about having your top secret clearances, which prevented you from getting therapy or treatment. And I find that really to be a shame. It's unfortunate. But you can write about you can't talk about the experiences, I guess, to other people, but you could write about them and bring those stories out in public. When you say you couldn't talk about them or write them, was it because it was too emotional for you to talk
Yes.
about them, or because it was top secret and you couldn't talk about it?
Oh, no, it wasn't top secret. Let me back up a little bit. My time in Vietnam, I can now tell you, it was declassified in 2017. And I was working for the National Security Agency, NSA.
Right.
I was there undercover. My job was working on the battlefield with the troops, working with intercepted North Vietnamese communications so I could tell the troops where the enemy was, what he was up to, what his plans were, what units were there, all that. And I was very, very successful, particularly when I was working with the Marine Corps, because they were very anxious to get all the information I could give them. I was very successful. I was so successful that I kept getting sent back. I spent between 1962 and 1975, I spent more time in Vietnam than I did in the U.S. because I kept getting sent back to work on the battlefield with the troops. The end result of that was that I went through some pretty ghastly stuff. But among the worst was the fall of Saigon. Tell me if I'm getting into too much detail here, but I'll tell you.
No. I mean, we're here to talk about your story and what you've gone. I wanted to ask you, when you're working with the troops, what was your position? I mean, were you like an Army sergeant or a colonel, or were you
No.
What were you considered at that point? I mean, how were you, dealing
with
them?
They all knew I was a civilian.
What did they consider
was,
you? That's the question.
They all knew I was a civilian, but I was undercover as an enlisted man, a low-ranking enlisted man, maybe a E-2 or E-3, on the battlefield with them, so that the enemy wouldn't spot me. I would look like just one of the troops.
Right.
And so the story of the fall of Saigon is very simple. I had 43 guys working for me. Their family, some of them had their families living in Saigon. In 1974, we signed a peace treaty with the North Vietnamese, so the war was considered over. It was no longer a wartime tour. It was now a gentleman's tour to go to Vietnam. I was there with my family, my second tour with my family. And I knew from intercepted North Vietnamese communications that the North Vietnamese were getting closer and closer to Saigon, and they were going to attack the city and conquer it. The ambassador, Graham Martin, didn't believe me. I kept going to him saying, look out, they're coming, we've got to prepare, call for an evacuation. He wouldn't do it. He never did call for an evacuation. He was finally his will was reversed from Washington, D.C. in the wee hours of the morning of the 29th of April after the North Vietnamese were already attacking the city.
Yeah.
I couldn't go because he wouldn't let me evacuate my people, and I wanted to get them all out of there. So I got them out of there by every means I could think of, lying and cheating and stealing. Some of them I sent out on phony home leave, others on vacations that they didn't have coming, others on business travel that didn't exist. And there's one story I'd love to tell about. I had two guys in my office who handled travel. And one day I said to them, next guy we got to get out is George. Where do you got going tomorrow? He said, well, the only flight tomorrow is to New Delhi in India. I said, okay, get George on that. And the reason is business trouble. And they said, well, we can't. And I said, why not? And I said, well, because we don't have any business in India. I said, do it anyway. And he said, but we can't. That's illegal. I said, do it anyway. Yes, sir. By the next day, those two guys had become experts on finding phony ways to get people out of the country so that it didn't, the ambassador wouldn't stop us. And I ended up getting them all out. My last two stayed with me until the very end. There was one radio operator and a guy who could keep the equipment working. They went out on the afternoon of the 29th of April after the North Vietnamese were already in the streets of the city. I was there until 8 o'clock that night. Went out in the pitch black, pouring rain. We were fired upon when the helicopter took off, but we made it. And flew out to the South China Sea. And so I was, well, I was in terrible physical shape at that point, but I was still alive. So that's
the story.
I think
everybody remembers the pictures. I mean, if they were alive, you know,
time,
the pictures of people hanging on helicopters, you know, as the choppers lifted off from the embassy in Saigon.
That's all true.
It was all, totally dramatic. When you say the book, I know your book was about Last of the Annamese. What does that word mean, Annamese? What is that?
Oh, you know I'm a linguist by trade. Two of my languages are Vietnamese and Chinese.
Okay.
There was a group of troublemakers in southern China more than 1,000 years ago that the Chinese called the Yuanan. That means the troublemakers in the south. In their own dialect, those troublemakers used their version of that, which was Vietnam troublemakers in the south. They eventually moved out of China, down into what is now Vietnam, and established their own country, and it had many different names over history. One of them was Annam, which does not mean troublemakers in the south, but peace in the south. And one of the characters in the book, Left of the Enemies, does not like to be being considered a troublemaker. He much prefers to think of himself as a peacemaker. So he calls the country Annam, and he is the last of the enemies. Someone from Annam in English is called an Annamese. So he is the last of the enemies.
I get it. All right. You know, it's interesting, your story. How did you, what was your background before you obviously went to work for NSA? Did you have that linguistic ability, you know, a master of seven different languages at that time? Obviously, that's one of the things that appealed to them, for sure.
Obviously. We Americans are very spoiled. We all think that learning a foreign language is very difficult and none of us do it and so on. But if you live in just about any place else in the world, people speak multiple languages. And everybody knows they have to learn more than one language, and they just accept that as normal. We don't do that. I didn't know any of that. As a child, I taught myself French and Italian just because I wanted to. I didn't think there was anything unusual about that. In high school, I had 4 years of Latin. In college, I studied German, among other things. And when I graduated from college, I wanted to study Chinese. I had grown up in the San Francisco Bay Area. I was surrounded by Chinese. I was fascinated by the language. I knew it was too difficult. I couldn't teach it to myself. So I wanted to go to the best language school in the world, the Army Language School in Monterey, California, also called the Defense Language Institute. So I enlisted in the Army with the proviso that they would send me to the language school to study Chinese. But when I got to the language school, they told me they weren't going to teach me Chinese. They were going to teach me a language I'd never heard of, Vietnamese. This was 1957.
Yeah.
And I was in the Army. I had to follow orders. So there I was. I was stuck. So I spent the next year in intensive study of this unknown language, Vietnamese, 6 hours a day in the classroom, 2 hours of private study every night, 5 days a week for 52 weeks. I graduated first in my class. There were only 10 of us in the class. I graduated first in the class. And I said to the Army, now send me to Vietnam. And they said no. Because they had nothing going on in Vietnam at that point. And instead, they assigned me to the National Security Agency. Once I got there, I found out that Georgetown University taught Chinese, so I enrolled as a part-time graduate student to study Chinese. So by the time my enlistment in the Army was finished, I was comfortable in Chinese, Vietnamese, and French, the three languages of Vietnam. NSA immediately hired me at 8 steps above the normal opening level to hire somebody. And
right.
In 1962, they sent me to Vietnam for the first time, and I was there until 1975. Spent more time in Vietnam than I did in the U.S. So that that tells you the background of that story. There's one
well,
more.
You must be. I mean, obviously, you're very smart. You have that ability to learn foreign languages. A lot of people, you know, it's very difficult for a lot of people. I don't think I could do that. I'm even studying, you know, 5 or 6 hours a day. Maybe I could. It would be tough. But God bless you. I'm in awe of people who have the ability of doing that, like you do. Good for you. So you have so many different books that are different things, but a number of the books you've written deal with Vietnam and your experiences there, obviously, and it involved a lot of time of your life. So let me ask you what it was like to sit down and start writing a book. Did you find that easy, or what was it? When did you know you could write? You could talk. You can do different languages. You know, you're brilliant in many areas. What made you think you could write a book?
I don't know how to answer that question. I knew when I was 6 years old, that's what I was born to do. So I spent my whole life preparing for that. Being a writer doesn't earn you any money, but being a linguist does, and being a spy especially does. So I became a spy and told you about my spying time to earn money. I retired from the government as early as I possibly could to write full time because I knew I had to do that. And once I did that, I couldn't wait to get started. And of course, I had been writing all along anyway, just about all my life. But after I
military
retired,
military reports.
Been...
Let me ask you something.
I mean,
you mentioned you. Go ahead.
Whenever I could, I would write.
Oh, you would? Okay, good. I just want to get something straight. Did you take your family? Were you married and took your family to Vietnam while you were there?
Yes, twice. I had two accompanied tours there. My first one, I only had one child. That was from 1963 to 1965. The second one was 1974 to 1975. Then I had my wife and my four children there. And I got them out of the country just 20 days before Saigon fell.
Wow.
And then my children still talk about their time in Vietnam. They remember it.
I'm sure it was quite an experience for them. No question about that.
Oh, yeah.
So when you began your writing career, let's talk about your first book. What was the first book you sat down to write and then publish?
Last of the Enemies.
That was it, the beginning one. Okay.
I'm sorry. I'm wrong about that. Last of the Enemies was not the first one. The first one was Friendly Casualties. And
right.
It's the only book of its kind I've ever seen. It's the first half of it is short stories. The second half of it is a novella in which all the elements of the short stories are brought together and shown how they came out. I published that book myself because I didn't think I would ever be able to get a publisher to accept any of my writing. All the other books that came after that, I decided I wasn't going to publish them myself. I was going to find a publisher. I couldn't get an agent to accept me. So what I did was I would finish the manuscript and then go look up a publisher, see what their requirements were, what they wanted me to send in as to apply for publication, and send it to them. And I kept doing that over and over and over again until somebody finally accepted the books and published them. And that's pretty much what I did with all my books, all six of them. And it turns out that Friendly Casualties is now about to be published in hard copy.
Good for you. And that was written when? That was the first one.
Oh,
that
boy.
That goes back a while, right?
I published that myself in 2012. I first started writing it, good Lord, I don't know. I had been writing all my life. And that's pretty much true with all the books. I had been working on them for years and years and years. But when I could work at it full time, I didn't have to worry about money after I retired. Then I was able to smooth them out and clean them up and get them published.
So that one is described, I guess, as a friendly casualties. They're all short stories. The second half is a novella that I understand was set in Vietnam, both talking about the unspeakable acts that occur during war.
Exactly.
What kind of comments did you get back? And who primarily do you think was that book aimed for? Was it for other guys who had been through those experiences in Vietnam? Or what would you say?
My writing about Vietnam and about war in general is not for people who have been through it, but for people who have not. One of my major goals in life is for people to understand how unspeakably grisly and horrifying combat is. It is the worst experience you can imagine. There's nothing quite as horrible as being on the battlefield, lying next to somebody who was killed right next to you, and more than half of him sloshes over onto you. And you look at him, and there's not even enough left of him to put in a body bag. Those experiences are so awful. I want people to know how unspeakably horrible war is, so they will be very careful about rushing off to war. I remind people that we are among the very few nations of the world who have never had a war on our own land that we can remember. The last one was the Civil War. Nobody living today remembers that. Almost every other nation in the world has had war on their own land, and they remember very vividly and very specifically how unspeakably awful it was. So they're much more hesitant to go into war than we are. And I want we Americans to be aware of that. So that's one of the major reasons I write.
You know, listening to you talk, it occurs to me, you're right. I don't know how bad being in combat on a battlefield is. I've read about it, but not to the extent the way you're describing it, and we certainly haven't seen it like that in any motion pictures that I can think of.
No, we glorify war as Americans.
Yeah. That's, you know, you make it sound like it's compelling to read, even though it certainly wouldn't be pleasant. Anyway, the book is called Friendly Casualties. Right.
Yeah, there's one other story I want to tell you. It's a little out of context, but I'll fit it in. After I got back after the fall of Saigon, about a year later, my guys, the 43 guys who had worked for me, got together down in the District of Columbia for dinner, and they invited me to come down. So I went down and had dinner with them. At the end of the meal, they presented me with a plaque. It's called the Last Man Out Award. They all knew, even though I tried to keep it, let me back up, I worked very hard for them not to know the ambassador didn't want me to evacuate them because I thought that would terrify them. They all knew. They were all reading the messages I was sending back to NSA and describing what was going on, so they knew perfectly well what was going on. I worked extremely hard to get them all out safely. I lied and cheated and stole, as I told you. They knew all that. So here it was, a year later, they gave me this plaque. On it, it says, the Last Man Out Award, and it thanks me for saving their lives.
Wow.
And
that's
I'm so
great.
Touched by that plaque.
Yeah, you should be.
That hangs on the most honored place in my house.
You then wrote a book called No Accounts, which talks the story about two men. One of them was gay and dying of AIDS, and the other a straight volunteer to help him die.
Yes.
How was that? How were you inspired to write that book?
In the 80s, I was suffering very badly from post-traumatic stress injury as a result of my time in combat in Vietnam and, frankly, elsewhere that I can't talk about because it's still classified. I had to find a way to cope with that. So one thing I did, as I told you, was to write. Once I could write down what happened, that helped me get over it. The other thing I discovered was if I could help other people who needed my help, if I was with them, my attention was so much on them that all my memories tended to fade into the background. Right about that time, men were dying on the street of AIDS, dying on the street because nobody would touch them. We didn't know how AIDS was transmitted from person to person, and people were terrified of AIDS. turned out that most of these men who were dying were gay. I didn't know why, but I knew that was true. I couldn't stand it. So I said to my wife, look, I've got to volunteer to help these guys. I just can't tolerate this idea of seeing people dying on the street and abandoned. And I said, if I do this, there's some chance I'll get AIDS, and if I do, you'll get it too, and it's fatal. She said, go do it. So I did. I volunteered with the Whitman Walker Clinic, a gay clinic in Washington, D.C., to help with people who were dying. I had 7 patients. They were all gay. They all died. And after 5 years, we found ways to prevent AIDS from killing people. It turned out it was no longer a fatal disease. So then, since I had learned to face death so well, I volunteered with a hospice. And for the next 9 years, I worked in a hospice with dying people. I finally had to quit that because one of the things I had to do was lift those people, help them move from place to place. And when I got so old, I couldn't do that anymore. I had to quit. So I finally did.
Yeah.
The end result of that was that I was so moved by my experience that I wanted to tell the story of a straight man working with a gay man dying of AIDS. And that's what led to the book, No Accounts.
Wow. Tell me a little bit, we only have a couple of minutes left. Tell me a little bit about how you write. Do you get up in the morning and force yourself to sit down at the typewriter and work, or how does it function with you as a writer?
When I can do it, when time will permit, I will write 14 hours a day. I said, come down first thing in the morning, write and write and write until I have to stop and eat something, come back, write and write, and keep at it. I'm very, very lucky in that respect. The words just flow out of me. All I have to do is sit down in front of the keyboard. The story is there. It's in my mind. I can't get it down fast enough. And then, of course, after the draft is done, I go back and revise. And generally, I revise every book at least 10 times over, which is one reason why it takes so long. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Which is one reason why it takes so long to write a book.
Yeah.
But the writing comes to me very quickly and very easily, and one thing I always do is read it aloud. And if I hear it, I'm a musician by trade, too, as you mentioned. I took a BA in music. And I listen to the music in the writing, and if it's beautiful, if it sings, then I know it's good, and I let it go. If it doesn't, I go back and rework on it some more, get it to sing. Does that answer your question?
It does. How many books have you written now so far? I had mentioned something. Is it like 7?
There are 6. No, 6 published books. I've got 2 more I'm working on now. But that's another question. Let me get off track here a little bit.
We'll talk about that. I want to point out, people may be so inclined to want to read these books. Do you have a website? Do you have or what's the best way for people to find your books? How would you answer that at this point?
Go look on Amazon.com under Tom Glenn. You'll find a whole huge, big display of all my books and everything about me and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
I have a blog. I don't have a website anymore. I used to, but now I just have a blog that I write every day. And that's just TomGlenn.blog. That's all it is. And if you type in TomGlenn.blog with a / after blog, you'll go to the website.
Very good. All right. Well, look, Tom, we're going to do this again. We're going to go into some of the other books coming up on July 5th. We're going to bring you back again and talk about some of the other stories. It's kind of amazing hearing exactly what you've been through and what you're doing now. I gather you love what you're doing now, really probably the best. Am I right, of what you've ever done?
I'm sorry, can you say that question again? I didn't understand.
Well, I just think you love what you're doing, let's put it that way, as a writer.
Oh, yes.
That this is it for you, right?
Except that I have a kind of writer's block as a result of the death of my partner, a woman I'd been with for more than 20 years. We'll talk about that next time, probably. But that's getting in my way right now. Other than that, the blog I write every day, and I'm doing what I most want to do.
Well, I'm sorry about the loss of your partner. I know that can be very, you know, that can be very traumatic to go through. It's another,
oh, yeah,
another something for you to go through. Well, anyway, Tom Glenn is our guest. He will be back again on July 5th at 1 o'clock, and we'll continue this conversation. Tom, thank you so much for joining us here on Close Up Talk Radio.
Oh, thank you. It was my pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You have been listening to a broadcast from Close Up Radio, a division.